You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 183, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Human Evolution, A Spiritual Scientific Quest, 9 lectures translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 1st of September 1918. Today, I need to structure the studies that we are engaged in here in such a way that I shall enlarge upon what was presented yesterday, in order to arrive at some kind of provisional conclusion tomorrow. What is said today will therefore be more of the nature of an episode. Events of the present time give one considerable reason to reflect about one thing or another, provided that one is not inclined to sleep through the most important impulses of our time. A particularly striking phenomenon which poses major questions at the present time, and is one that must be familiar to you, is the immeasurable untruthfulness that has taken hold today in the broadest sense, and specifically where a wider vision is being upheld. Phenomena such as the appearance of such a trenchant and radical untruthfulness are then also a stimulus for a spiritual scientific investigation of everything associated with it. And in this respect, one is frequently confronted by a fact that I have already mentioned on several occasions, namely that much of what is communicated to mankind as history is a kind of fable convenu. The point here is not so much that facts that are communicated cannot be substantiated to a certain degree. What is more significant is that other facts, you may recall my telling you recently, about the profound influence exercised by a certain person, has simply been deleted from Roman history, are obliterated. The Church has obliterated an immense amount of facts from history, because it was important to the Church that certain facts did not come to people's knowledge. Yesterday we spoke from a certain point of view about the time which inaugurated the Greco-Latin cultural epoch, namely the important period in the 8th century B.C. It is a time of which historical traditions have little to impart. Although these traditions are full of uncertainty, one personality shines out from the beginning of this period of time who has succeeded in being studied in all sorts of different ways by a great number of people. From this early time, shortly after the 8th century B.C., the time of Pythagoras lights up, and also the name of the Pythagorean school. Yesterday I indicated that Pythagoras had been able to receive remnants of truths from the ancient Egyptian mysteries, and I gave something of the nature of these truths. It is not only interesting to consider what Pythagoras and his pupils said and did, which was very far-reaching, for they did not only develop a school, but were also very active politically. What Pythagoras and his pupils did is interesting, but it is important to study the world that surrounded their activities, for this was the world out of which Greek culture subsequently grew, influenced, as it also was to a certain extent, by the particular radiance that was embodied in Pythagoras. If one studies life in the 7th, 6th, and 5th centuries B.C., which was the prelude to the later Greco-Roman age, if one studies life on the Greek peninsula, in the neighboring countries, and on the Italian peninsula, one is, provided that one is not looking in accordance with a preconceived picture, but is being guided in one's studies by the light of truth, for which spiritual scientific research represents an essential contribution, struck by the prevalence of one particular human trait in this geographical context. There has hardly been a time when there has been so much lying as in the countries around the Mediterranean Sea in this period. Lying, telling people things that are untrue, was a very striking and characteristic quality of the life out of which Greek and Roman culture emerged. One must not be under any illusions over such matters. All the immense beauty, the admirable wealth of imaginative creations of Greece, and the most amazing number of abstract thoughts ever given to the world, which were developed in Roman culture, all this grew, as does the plant world, out of manure, from a foundation of human beings inhabiting the area around the Mediterranean, who were completely impregnated with an obsessive passion for lying. This is something that is little spoken of in history, but it must be understood if one would gain any true insight into the declining period of the third post-Atlantean cultural period. As we approach the 8th century BC from the preceding centuries and millennia, we are indeed passing through the declining period of this third post-Atlantean epoch of culture. And the people who were the bearers of the third post-Atlantean cultural period were consummate liars. This is also that epoch when the faculty of which I spoke to you yesterday, and which is so extraordinarily interesting, developed in a quite particular way, the faculty of forming language out of the cosmic power of reason. And alongside all these things that I explained to you yesterday, the greatest conceivable talent was invested, at that time, in the obsessive desire to lie. If one is being properly realistic, one should no more allow oneself to be deluded about these things than about a violet which flowers in the spring and then fades, and has within it these transient forces while it is in full bloom. In the violet, the forces of coming into being and destruction follow one another in time. In human life, especially in the wider context of the life of humanity, these forces are very often engaged simultaneously, and we do not understand reality if we fail to see that things such as evolution, the potential for constructive activity, as for example in the forming of words and speech, and devolution, the devastating effect that lying has on one's inner life, take place alongside one another. This is, as it were, the shadow side of what I spoke to you about yesterday. There is also a light side. This light side belongs more to the realm of spiritual scientific research. Yesterday I already drew your attention to the fact that it would not be possible to speak with such certainty about the forming of language if the life of man after death did not provide clear proof of this process, in that words that are formed out of individual elements or portions of words here in life are again separated out into their different elements. This loosening process, this disintegration of words, is something that plays a significant part in the life of the dead. In a certain sense, a dead person lives by virtue of this disintegration of words. Such a person has the very definite feeling that during his life, thus before his death, he was excluded from the spiritual world in which he now is, through having formed composite words out of sounds and letters. A dead person has the feeling that language is like a curtain that is placed during his life between him and the spiritual world. And when the curtain is taken down and words are resolved into their constituent parts, he has the feeling that he is again entering the spiritual world. Hence, one of the characteristic actions of a dead person is to break up or pull to pieces the human words that the individual concerned learned during his life between birth and death. He has, for example, a real sense of celebration when he manages to acquire a certain understanding as a result of this disintegration process. I have often spoken to you of how the moment of death is indeed, from a certain point of view, a fearful event as far as life in a physical body is concerned. People greatly prefer to avert their eyes from death. After death, the spectacle of this event is, as I have often emphasized, always present. But there is nothing terrifying about it. For as a person contemplates his own death from the other side of existence, he has in this spectacle the everlasting certainty that he is and remains an ego. I have often made this clear. But the dead person now has to understand what is revealed to him from the other side of existence as he contemplates death. His understanding increases as he breaks up the words from whichever language he may have spoken. The ancient Hebrews, and somewhat similarly also the Romans, had their so-called holy names, the unutterable name of God, Jehovah or Yahweh. This unutterable name consisted for the Hebrews in a certain combination of the sounds experienced by us as the five vowels, which were thought of as linked together during physical life. In the Roman Jovis, Jupiter, is concealed another form of the name Yahweh, where the five vowels are essentially being combined in a certain way. The dead person lived in the dissolution of what was combined in the name of God. And as he broke up the vowels that were brought together during life, he had at the same time a revelation of what one might call the meaning of death. We must try to gain some sort of an inkling of what was revealed as the meaning of death. What we need to understand is that the meaning of death is revealed to the dead person through the dissolution of the holy name into its component parts, which then continue to sound forth throughout the universe. The dissolution of this holy name is associated with an understanding of the spiritualization of death. This is a concept that is extraordinarily difficult to describe. Death, when viewed from yonder side, can be referred to as a spiritualization. When we look at death from this point of view, what we perceive is associated with the arising of the spiritual dimension. Whereas one may experience this process of disintegration in a negative way as something ugly, as one does with anything destructive, this particular process of destruction, when viewed from yonder side of existence, manifests itself as a lighting up of the spiritual domain, which, as it reverberates out into the universe, is then understood. It is as if the holy word were sounding and raying forth, while disintegrating into the vowels of which it is composed, which then become audible, as though from the periphery of the universe, and enable the meaning of death, the spiritual meaning of death, to be understood as an oral experience. This will lead you to see that it is justifiable to speak of the members of man's being that he possesses between death and a new birth, just as one speaks here in life of the physical body, ether body, astral body, and ego. For now I have told you of the central experience that a person has between death and a new birth, namely the revelation of the spiritual meaning of death. The question must necessarily arise, What does this world that is revealed to human beings after their death look like? The only way to understand this is to come to know something about the nature and essential being of man himself. Today, we shall begin by trying to describe the person who has died as one would describe someone who is living. We can start with that member of the dead person that still has a considerable connection, not an affinity, but a connection, with what man experiences between birth and death. The first member of human nature with which we are concerned is, therefore, what we can also call the capital I or ego, which is what one calls the initially highest member of human nature between birth and death. Immediately after death, it still initially retains the sheath of the ether body, which then dissolves in the course of time. These are aspects of it that do not actually belong to it. If one is speaking of the dead human being, the ego is the only member of this person who has died, which can be recognized as being uniquely his own. I said that there is a connection with the ego of the earthly life, but there is no actual affinity. For in point of fact, the ego manifests itself in a totally different way after death from how it is experienced between birth and death. Between birth and death, the ego has a certain fluid quality, something that enables it to feel that it has the power to become different every day. Just imagine how dreadful it would be to live in a body between birth and death if you were not able to say to yourself, "Yesterday I did something I should not have done, but I can make amends. I can do something good to make up for it." Or, suppose you were obliged to realize that you learned very little in your earlier years, but you are unable to learn anything more. At no moment in the life between birth and death is the ego so inflexible that it cannot bring about some sort of inner transformation through exerting its own will. What you experience as the ego after death is something that has become rigid. It has acquired certain qualities that cannot immediately be changed. It stays the way it is. The essential point to be grasped in order to understand the ego after death is the transformation of the constantly fluid nature of the ego between birth and death into a rigid structure where nothing is able to change, and which remains as it has become in the course of life. After death, there is no question of a development, such as we may attribute to the ego between birth and death. After death, the ego is, as it were, a rigid spiritual structure that arises from a contemplation of death, and nothing about this ego can be changed. To put it plainly and simply, one might say that after death, a person is condemned to see all the details of his life as something fixed. In the same way that when you look out over a field, you see both the vegetation that is distant and close at hand all together, and you do not see anything of a fluid nature, but a fixed, extended, and semi-permanent form, so do you behold the full extent of the course of your life, not, as happens with life in a physical body, in a panorama, where what is in the foreground merges into the background, but as a definite and lasting vista, where you are unable to change anything merely by looking at it. It would, moreover, fare badly with the dead person if this were not so. For the ego lays a considerable claim to what the gaze of a dead person beholds. He is, as it were, captivated by this ego. And were this ego to vanish from the scene, it would, for the dead person, be as if the world of the senses that surrounds the living were to disappear. It is indeed true to say that the individual human being in his ego is actually as important to himself, if I may put it thus, as the whole world of the senses that we share as human beings is for the physical aspect of man's being. A vast abyss would open up, an abyss of nothingness, if we were unable, after death, to behold the ossified ego that has congealed out of its fluid state. As a second member of man's being after death, we have a kind of spirit being that we can, by way of an analogy with what we already know, also call the spirit self. The person concerned becomes conscious of this spirit being mainly through this awareness of the spirit self rising up as though from within. Whereas the ego offers a kind of outward perspective, the consciousness of the spirit self emerges from within. And to the same extent that one feels that this spirit self is inwardly stirring, so does one become aware that the beings of the higher hierarchies are present. So, if I am to avoid telling you something inaccurate, I would need to define it as I am writing it on the blackboard, the spirit self directed by the hierarchies toward the ego. What I have written accurately describes the situation. You have the feeling that a being from the hierarchy of the Angeloi, or from the hierarchy of the Exousiai, is now directing your gaze toward your ego. By virtue of the fact that you are directing your gaze toward your ego, at one time through the agency of a being of one hierarchy, and at another time because you know that your gaze is now being directed toward your ego by a being of another hierarchy, you are getting to know this hierarchy out of the activity of your spirit self. So you are getting to know the hierarchies out of your own activity. You are beginning to find yourself in the company of the hierarchies through your spirit self. And whereas, before this spirit self lights up, you still have the feeling that only you are engaged in directing your gaze toward your own ego, you begin to feel ever more clearly that increasing numbers of beings of the higher hierarchies are concerning themselves with you and are becoming involved with your perception, directing your gaze. As you develop your higher sense activity, you increasingly feel through the spirit self that the beings of the higher hierarchies are participating in this supersensible sense activity. What would be unendurable for people in the material world becomes the very element of life in the condition that they inhabit after death. Just imagine that you were standing here at the window and looking out at the surroundings. The person sitting nearest comes up and turns your head in order to enable you to see something in that direction. Then a second person comes and inclines your head slightly upward so that you see something else again. And so the whole company of people sitting here approach you from behind. And the aspect of your outward surroundings that you see would depend on the people sitting here continually turning your head this way or that. If you now think of this not as viewed from outside, but as an inner experience, an inner feeling, you have a true analogy of this experience that you have as your spirit self. You increasingly make yourself part of the life of the higher hierarchies through these higher hierarchies entering into the directing of your gaze. The beings of the higher hierarchies are also involved in the dissolution of words, of which we have already spoken. This is one aspect of what is experienced then. But this ever-increasing familiarity with the hierarchies leads to a continual enrichment of life. Moreover, in a wholly similar way, One gets to know the beings with whom one had some kind of karmic connection before death. One feels that one is being led or guided. This is what can be said about the second member of man's being in the life between death and a new birth. What can be said about the third member may perhaps come as something of a shock to one's ordinary human understanding. As one participates in this life after death, one gradually feels that one is being imbued with a certain power, with what I might perhaps describe as a nexus of forces. After one has initially felt the hierarchies approaching and guiding one in a supersensible sense activity, if I may express it in this way, one gradually feels that these hierarchies are gently imbuing one with power, with a certain force. One has the feeling of being gradually filled with this power that the hierarchies bring with them as they enter into us, as they delicately engage their essential being with us. One gradually becomes sensitive to this power. One feels not only that one's attention is directed by the hierarchies toward this or that, but that one is oneself, inwardly filled with strength, as a result of this activity of the hierarchies, which manifests itself as an activity that facilitates visionary perception. We feel the forces of the cosmos itself streaming into us like enlivening fluids. But what is so startling is that the forces that we now feel streaming into us are of a quite particular kind. They are forces that quite definitely do not promote life as we know it in the physical world. Rather, do they disintegrate and destroy it? We feel ourselves gradually being filled with a cosmic death-bringing power. It is important to be open to such extraordinary ideas, because only in this way can the spiritual world be properly understood. Just imagine your soul and spiritual nature being gradually filled with forces of which, as you inwardly experience them, you have the awareness that everything that lives here on the earth would be killed if you were to come in contact with it. So in the third place, you clothe yourself in what, by way of an analogy, with something we already know we can call the life spirit. You clothe yourself in something that one can call the life spirit, but its most distinctive quality is that it is fatal to the functioning of the life body. You therefore acquire a third member of your being, which enables you to kill every ether body that comes across your path. Everything that you contact through this member of your being becomes dead, in the sense that one speaks of death here on earth. And as you kill by means of these forces that you receive, you awaken spiritual life, or initially, actually, soul life, from what has been killed. It is indeed an extraordinary experience to encompass that the living is killed through contact with the living, but soul life is brought into being, is released by this killing. It is a death-bringing process. But it is at the same time a liberation of soul forces from the fetters of life. Thus one can say that the life spirit kills the earthly aspect of the living, releasing within it forces of soul. And the source of this remarkable experience is that soul forces are in a sense enchanted within what is living, and that through the process which is enacted after death, the enchanted soul forces are liberated from out of the living. One might be inclined to see something terrible and repellent in the destructive way in which the force of which we have been speaking works. This is not by any means the case, insofar as the life after death is concerned, because in this death-bringing power there resides a continual illumining of soul life, a capacity to kindle soul life into being. Moreover, the dead person needs to have this consciousness, not only so that he can contemplate the death that he has himself undergone, but he also has to be conscious of the fact that the essential nature of his death is spread over the whole foundation of what he now experiences in the spiritual world. It is as if one henceforth lives in the spiritual world in such a way that one can say that here in the spiritual world, forms of a spiritual nature are continually arising, although initially they are actually forms of soul life, and soul life is engendered in a variety of different ways. But if one were to ask about the nature of the soil, whence all this soul substance springs forth, the source is the death-bringing force of which we have just been speaking. And so, a power that destroys ordinary life on earth becomes the essential soul nature that we need to acquire between death and a new birth, just as in earthly life we have to acquire our carnal body. A fourth member of man's being between death and a new birth may, again by analogy with what we already know, be called the spirit man. Spirit man in this connection is experienced in such a way that in addition to the forces with which one has already been imbued by the hierarchies, as I have already described, one is impregnated with the possibility not only of killing and destroying life, that is what we call life here on earth, and bringing it to a state of disintegration, but of utterly destroying forms and translating them into different forms. Bracket, the following words were written on the blackboard, close bracket. Number one, the ego. Number two, the spirit self, directed by the hierarchies toward the ego. Number three, the life spirit kills what is known in the earthly sense as the living, releasing within it forces of soul. Number four, the spirit man. It does, of course, become more and more difficult to describe these things, but essentially, the force of the spirit man as it lives in a human being between death and a new birth is such that one thereby carries out an activity that is the very opposite of what can be associated in the widest sense with the engendering of forms. To take a specific example, here on earth one draws triangles, squares, and so forth. After death, by virtue of the forces that are being developed in this realm, one does the opposite. One dissolves all forms that one has drawn. But the strange thing is that this does not simply mean that a form is done away with. It is at the same time a cosmic activity. One is oneself in the midst of cosmic activity, connected with cosmic activity. For this deconstruction process, this dissolving of forms, is a cosmic activity. And when a dead person, who has been imbued with the life spirit, acquires this power of deconstruction, this power of dissolving forms, he has become part of the cosmic world. He works within the cosmos itself. What has to do with destruction and decline here on earth is closely associated with the processes of coming into being and formation in the spiritual worlds and vice versa. What appears here as destruction and decline, deconstruction and dissolution of form, has a lot to do with coming into being in yonder worlds of spirit. So, when I speak of deconstruction and dissolution of form, I'm not speaking of decline in the spiritual world, but only of decline in the world of soul, and I am indeed speaking of the appearance of something spiritually new in the spiritual world. Many mysteries in the world have a connection with these things. As you approach the southern part of Italy from the central part of the country today, you will find regions that are poor and not particularly fertile, where only a meager amount of nature's riches are available to human beings. These are the same regions where Pythagoras was active at the dawn of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. And in his day, Pythagoras was working in an area that was very fertile, abundant, and luxuriant. It has been such a short time since that period. And yet if we consider this little portion of the earth where Pythagoras was active, we can see the transformation from a fertility and luxuriance that was on a sybaritic scale to poverty, even to the point where serious illnesses arise. Instead of a budding, luxuriant life such as existed in those times where historical research has little access, something has developed which, in comparison to that luxuriant, vigorous life, amounts to a real poverty of nature. It is highly interesting to observe such transitions in the outer world, where coming into being and passing away are perpetually interlinked. However, those engaged in historical research are not so advanced in their thinking that they make the right connections between these continual processes of coming into being and passing away. Pythagoras developed his activities amidst vigorous luxuriance, where lying was rife, and the influence of these activities continued after his death. And what Pythagoras and the Pythagorean souls had to accomplish after their death is connected in many ways with what came to be manifested in the decline of the blossoming, sprouting life in the midst of which Pythagoras lived. Pythagoras and the souls of his followers were not wholly without a share in the work of destruction, which for yonder world is a task of bringing something into being, that arose in the period after Pythagoras, in the place where nature was formerly luxuriant and plentiful. In order to understand the world as a whole, one has to get used to the idea that things look quite different, depending on whether one's viewpoint is here, between birth and death, or between death and a new birth. Someone who would be committing a crime if he were arbitrarily to destroy a rich and abundant life in the earthly domain is merely doing something that happens as an eternal necessity when he participates in an endeavor between death and a new birth that here on earth clearly signifies decline and decay. Something was meant to come to an end with the third post-Atlantean epoch, and this left its shadows behind it. Much had to come to an end in a different domain from the one that has just been referred to. This declining aspect of the third post-Atlantean epoch has a significant bearing on the prevalence of lying at that time. The reason for all this lying on the earth was that people were, as I explained yesterday, still connected with cosmic forces. But the cosmic forces that exerted their influence upon earthly evolution before the 8th century BC were in many ways of a deceitful nature. Demonic liars were active in the sphere into which the soul of man entered while he was developing words, as I described this process yesterday. He had, so to speak, to extend the head region of his soul into a sphere where he could do this, the sphere of cosmic reason or intelligence. But within this sphere there were those Ahrimanic forces that came to expression in the activity of countless lying demons. And out of this same source, whence the language-forming power of that time was derived, there developed this colossal power of lying on the soil of Mediterranean culture. People lied because the demons who introduced the capacity of forming languages were liars. It was the task of these demonic liars to bring about the decline of what had to decline in order that the third post-Atlantean period could come to an end and the fourth one could take its place. The world is ordered in accordance with necessities, and one needs to pay attention to these necessities if one is seeking to answer the great question that we posed at the beginning of our studies yesterday, the question of the connection of the moral and the non-material realm of ideas with the processes of nature. I shall speak further about this tomorrow, thereby bringing these studies to a provisional conclusion. The end of Lecture 8.